on the heartstrings by showing people falling. I mean, they did all of the emotional things that one would expect to have a successful manipulation. Now, it's only 7-8 years after the fact when we look back on it and see how they orchestrated it and see how they pulled those emotional strings that, in fact, we see it as a deception. And there were some things they did wrong, Jeff. One of them was they reported that Building 7 had fallen. And right behind the person reporting this on the BBC, Building 7 is still up. And she's standing there saying, Building 7 has just fallen. It has fallen 6 hours after the first two buildings went. And here she is reporting on a building that had not yet fallen, and it was right behind her head as she was saying it. In other words, she was reading off of a press release that had arrived to her in advance of the actual building being taken down, which is astonishing. So
that fact I'm not aware of. That's very interesting.
It is, and it's really a shocker when you see her saying this, and then the Building 7 is standing on the right side of her head. It's amazing. But anyway, and it's been verified on another network that did the exact same thing. Apparently, somebody sent out the press for them to read in advance a little bit too early. But we're going to go here now. You start talking a little bit about the Congress getting involved in this. You talk about the White House and Wolfowitz and so forth. But you also get involved here, too, in the Israeli Knesset talking about it. So you want to meet the press, you talk about. What is really the flow of this particular subheading in this first chapter?
Yeah, you have to manage this. The politics of this has to be managed and managed very tightly in order to pull off these types of operations because they are such a large scale. But when you've got enough pre-staging, when you have enough people put into the Congress, and we addressed this in the last session,
yeah,
so that you have the bulk of the Congress beholding to the Israel lobby, then, for example, when Colin Powell went to the region in March 2002, the Israel lobby and the Christian Zionist evangelical leaders immediately went to the Congress and began to get votes in support of Israel. And so you had the House and the Senate passed pro-Israeli resolutions, 94-2 in the Senate, 352-21 in the House, signing America's solidarity with Israel, a common struggle against terrorism. A New York Congresswoman named Nita Lowy actually approved $200 million through a subcommittee in the House Appropriations for money that the Bush administration absolutely did not want, and they reluctantly signed the legislation. While Colin Powell is in the region, all this stuff is ongoing, and before he even leaves, Netanyahu tells the press that Colin Powell's trip won't amount to anything. And by the time Colin Powell, the U.S. Secretary of State, got back, the Israelis had run an operation in the United States where Colin Powell came back, and he realized he was running U.S. foreign policy, and it certainly was not him, mm-hmm. nor was it the U.S. president.
Yeah.
So that's the extent of influence and control, and until the American public realizes that, realize that they have indeed lost control of their representative system. It's no longer based on people who are come from a particular state. It's not based on district and Senate anymore. It's based on the amount of money that the Israel lobby can fund into election campaigns to put sympathetic people in office. And that's a very strong charge because people really do believe they live in a representative system. But if they look again, it's that particular chapter, it's the introduction, is actually posted on the criminal state website. So if you go there, you can just read the simple math, the simple dollar math whereby this crowd displaced representative system, representative government. And once you've got enough people there that will side with you, then you do precisely the kind of operation that they've done. And
there's another side note. You mentioned this woman, Lowy. Well, did you know that the partner in the World Trade Center purchase was actually Silverstein and a man named Frank Lowy? No surprises there. There are connections from the operations themselves that go right back into congressional associations and government associations. It's sort of like George Bush's brother, of course, running security for those buildings and quitting the day before the 9/11 attacks. It'll be Marvin Bush. And of course, he goes back to involvement in savings and loan theft and the whole bit. All of this stuff, if you'll take a look at it without pointing to the names and dates and people, it can seem like you could make the case that it's a coincidence. But the fact is, once you've really put names and faces to all the participants, it's absolutely impossible that it's coincidence. In fact, it's conspiracy.
Yeah, let me address that, because it's easy for a listener to think because, say, Marvin Bush has some association with it, that he's somehow consciously complicit in it. And that would miss the point. You find that typically the people who are used and made to appear guilty by association are often assets of this. Assets meaning people who've been profiled in sufficient depth that they will, you know, behave consistent with their profile in a time, place, and circumstance. So if you manage to put this guy on a corrupt SNL, as one of the Bush boys was done, suddenly he's made rich by this corrupt connection. You've turned him into an asset, and they're routinely deployed in other operations. So you would have brought in you would have put him in a circumstance and induced his resignation just at the right time, so that then people could come back and say, "See, we told you it was all a Bush operation."
That's right. That's right, and it's Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Bush, and what that does is it gives these people plausible deniability.
Well, it's a form of disinformation and misinformation. It takes you off the mark, and it has to be plausible enough that you can get, you know, people like this Michael Moore doing movies to, you know, use a classic guilt by association, storyline. You know, there's a Bin Laden member on the Carlisle board, and George Herbert Walker's on the Carlisle board. Therefore, the invasion of Iraq is all about Bush oil. And people buy into that stuff. They really do, because they're desperate for answers. It's entertaining. It looks credible. And now you got a whole enormous number of conspiracy theories online, of course, about this. And it's all misdirection. It's all disinformation. And if you look behind it, you'll find, as in the case of Fahrenheit 9/11, you'll find, you know, Harvey Weinstein and
Rahm Emanuel's brother.
And Rahm Emanuel's brother, the producer, and Michael Eisner, the owner of Disney, Harvey Weinstein, the primary shareholder and the subsidiary known as Miramax, promoting this movie so that it opened on a record number of screens. And so you've got enough impressions and eyeballs looking at this, enough people writing about it in the media to say this is the best thing since sliced bread, that indeed people believe it. And that goes right to the point. You displace facts with what you can be induced to believe. So you've got an enormous group of the population say this is all about Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and not nonsense. They're all highly dysfunctional, self-absorbed, people who've been used by this. They are classic assets, particularly Cheney. But you get this, highly dysfunctional Christian Zionist, born again, recovering alcoholic that you position for the presidency as a brand name political family, and you put him in. You preempt the GOP primary, so you know he's going to be the nominee. You put him in office. But even with the 2000 election, as with the 2008 election, both sides were covered. John McCain would have been equally acceptable as Barack Obama. It's a distinction without much difference when it comes to advancing this agenda that is this syndicate's goal.
Well, and so far, at least on the surface, they believe that they're going to be successful. But I think there are enough people out there now that have other plans for them, and I'm one of them. Terror as a tactic. Again, the idea of modern terrorism was certainly born in the late 40s with the Irgun and the Stern Gang and the rest. And we know that there is no group on earth that has perfected the art of murdering innocent civilians better than the Israelis and better than the Mossad. And you can go back to the Lavon affair when they were caught, but there have been hundreds of bombings. There's been Bali, and there's been these people, the Bader-Meinhof gang or Abu Nidal. You can go back and start looking into these things and find out they all have connections to the real masterful terrorists in the world. And again, it's a very effective tool, because if you've got the right press organ presenting the case for who did it, and of course they're going to tell you that the wrong people did it, but everybody's emotional about it. The same thing with these shootings, the gun shootings. We can go back to Dunblane, or we can go back down to the Hobart shooting, where they want to get guns out of the hands of the public, and it worked. It worked in Britain. They're not allowed to have guns anymore. It worked in Australia. They're not allowed to have guns anymore. So now they've got a neutered public. And they put these operations into full force, and they're willing to kill anybody they need to kill to get their ends met, Jeff.
Yeah, let me give you a couple of examples. I mean, you can go on for dozens and dozens, as you indicated, but I just included a couple in this particular chapter to show how game theory works. Let me just mention a couple of them. In April 12th of 2002, Secretary of State Powell sits down with Ariel Sharon. At the same moment that he sits down, there's a suicide bombing in Israel that kills 8 and injures 22. You fast forward to May 10th, at the same moment that Bush sits down with Ariel Sharon, there's another suicide bombing in Israel. Fast forward another month, June 2003, a year 13 months later, on the same day that Ariel Sharon visits the White House, you have an enormous suicide bombing, kills 17, wounds 100 on a bus in Jerusalem. And then you go, if you're trying to get this coalition group together to sort of stick with this nonsense that, you know, there's this global war on terrorism, then it helps if while the president of Italy is visiting the U.S., Italy suffers the greatest wartime casualty since World War II when 19 Italians are killed in Iraq, while the president of Italy is in the United States. While President Bush is visiting Tony Blair in London, the British envoy in Istanbul is killed along with 27 others, again, by a terrorist blast. While the president of Spain is visiting the U.S., 7 Spanish intelligence officers are killed in Iraq. And you go down the list, and that's all power of association. In retrospect, you look back and you go, you just look for the patterns. You look for the repetitive patterns.
That's right. They don't move far from the game plan because it's so effective. Am I correct?
Well, the nice thing about this is there's a very limited repertoire.
Yeah.
You know, of things that can be used. So what we're doing with this series and this initial book is simply show people how this works.
Yeah, that's right.
And then they'll pick up their paper and they'll see it themselves. When they turn on Wolf Blitzer or they pick up the New York Times, you go, oh, there they are. I see them now. Here's how this works. And once Joe and Josephine Sixpack can see it for themselves, and I think that we're close to that. I join you in being encouraged. I think this is becoming more and more transparent. But the way you're really going to turn this is you're going to put the assets themselves, the people like the John McCains and the Barack Obamas, whose political career is traceable to these people. But for this particular syndicate, they would not have had a political career. Now, that doesn't mean that they're evil people and they're consciously complicit in this. It means they've been profiled with sufficient depth that you know if you put them in a time, place, and circumstance that you can help control, they'll perform consistent with their profile.
Well, can I agree to disagree on that and say that they know a lot more than just being dupes and used? I happen to believe that the fact that his wife had connections to the Brofmans back in the 20s and 30s is common knowledge in their family, and they know what side of their bread is buttered on, and I happen to think they're far more far better informed than being just useful idiots,
I would take this twist on that. I think what John McCain is doing is John McCain. He is playing out whatever John McCain's needs are. If you look at it, he is not with you when you look at him in the room. He is he's somewhere inside himself. He's self-consumed. He's self-absorbed. He is doing whatever John McCain thinks John McCain does when he gets up on the stage. Anyone who's worked around him, including lots of members of the Senate, who he quickly silenced, so this guy is way too unstable to be, commander-in-chief. This people are in his own party. If you've talked to staff who worked with him, as I have, he's got an incredibly volatile temper. He goes after people very personally. This is not a stable personality. So he is. Yes, it's true that he was put there by people who traced directly to the Bachman family, and that's detailed in the book, and we've discussed it in the last round of it.
Yep.
But I have no reason to think that he is consciously a traitor, that he is consciously selling out this country. I don't think that's the case. I think he is doing John McCain. But you never saw John McCain after 9/11 when he wasn't with Joe Lieberman. And they were the first ones out front saying, we've got to invade Iraq. So I think John McCain is simply acting out his dysfunction.
I'm going to respectfully agree to disagree on that one, but we'll go on to the next one here on organized crime in Arizona, chapter 2, which is important to develop here because what you've done here, not necessarily describing the individuals in Arizona, but using it as a template, because we could be doing an expose on John Kerry in Massachusetts, or we could be doing we could be talking about the use of the Terminator over there in California and his connections to Evelyn Rothschild. So basically what you did is you used Arizona as a study to show people how it works. Am I correct in saying that?
Yeah, that's correct, and it helps have living here. I'm literally living where John McCain opened his first congressional district office in Tempe, Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And my colleague and I were drawn here because organized crime is at control of the state of Arizona since the late 1920s.
Well, let's get involved in a little bit and give people a history, which you did slightly in the first instance when we had the show last week. But about how the prohibition gave them the vehicle they needed to nationally syndicate their crime network, and used the profits from it, and used their influence within it to strengthen a network. And it when alcohol became legal again, of course they moved into legal businesses around it, but then they moved on to many other things using the network that they had developed. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's when we passed prohibition, you could neither distill spirits in the United States nor sell them. Canadians also passed legislation saying you could distill them, but you could not sell them. So that immediately gave the Canadian distillers, primarily the Bronfman clan, a phenomenal market. And a lot of that booze was brought across the border right just there north of Detroit, where Ontario is where the Bronfmans are located. It flowed down into places like Arizona. And effectively, I mean, the way this operates is it doesn't matter whether you believe that booze should be legal or illegal. If you make it illegal, then you've effectively created a monopoly for people willing to operate outside the law.
Yeah.
So you not only created incredible profits, which capitalized organized crime, you also, after this group began killing each other for territory, they convened in Atlantic City in 1929, basically to cut the nation up into 24 exclusive territories, five of them around New York City, and the rest dispersed other places. So they quit killing each other for territory, and they had Murder, Inc. as the enforcement arm. Then in 1931, they met again in Manhattan, the Franconia Hotel. That was Jews only, and one of the fellows there said, I don't want to be working with these Italians, and so they handled that because the Italians were the cover for this.
Yep.
And they just killed him and brought somebody else in. You not only capitalized organized crime, you also created a distribution network, many of those 24 exclusive territories, which remain quite viable. And you also, by doing that, you also were able to profile politicians who were willing to work with you. Because if drinking booze was illegal and you were an elected official and you showed up at a speakeasy, suddenly they had you marked.
Yeah.
You're willing to operate outside the law.
Mm.
And basically it is that initial capitalization and distribution system and ability to profile people that is still operating. It's much more sophisticated now, but that's what helped it to go to scale, and it began with a key node out here in Arizona, which I think was the origin of your question.
Well, a couple of the names here that you've marked on this first page after the opening of the second chapter, Frank Costello, Meyer Lansky, you've got Moses Mo Dalitz, Dutch Schultz. I mean, these people, this is the who's who of the most vile criminals of the 30s. And you can see, a lot of people won't even know that Frank Costello was from the Jewish community. But the fact is, all of these people either were directly working from the Jewish community, or they had direct ties. And when they do the movies out of Hollywood, and they Meyer Lansky in the background when they did the Bugsy movie, it doesn't ever give you the real power this guy had over the syndicate. It was astonishing what he was able to do out of New York and out of Chicago. And again, what you said was very important, Jeff, that he used the connections to the Italians in both Chicago and New York as covers. And he set up those families. Now, he allowed those people to make some money for themselves, but really, the bulk of all that money and the trash hauling and the Teamsters and the rest of it went back into the coffers of the Zionist criminals. Am I correct?
Well, that's correct. I mean, it's easy. For example, most people associate organized crime in Chicago with Al Scarface Capone.
Yeah.
What they don't realize is Al was not from Chicago. He was from Brooklyn. He was from the Williamsburg area of Brooklyn, where he ran a violent gang, as did one of his colleagues named Johnny Torrio. Johnny was sent to Arizona, to Chicago first, and then Al Capone. Now, the way this works, they would have been profiled. They would be what we call assets. They would have been profiled as sufficiently psychopathic and reliably so that they could become the Italian or Sicilian face on organized crime. In the case of Frank Costello, he was married to a woman named Bobby Geigerman. After Prohibition ended, Fiorella LaGuardia was elected mayor of mayor of New York, and a little like Elliot Ness would take sledgehammers to bust up the booze, he took sledgehammers and started busting up the slot machines, which is what organized crime went into after Prohibition. Huey Long, I worked for his son in the Senate, took a train up to New York and persuaded Frank Costello to move the slot operations down to New Orleans. He sent a guy named Dandy Phil Castell. He walked with a gold cane. He sent Dandy Phil to live in the Roosevelt Hotel in New Orleans, which was Huey Long's southern headquarters. Along with Dandy Phil Castell came the four brothers-in-law of Frank Costello. He was married to a woman named Bobby Geigerman. So you had Dandy Phil and Bobby's, you know, four brothers down there living in the Roosevelt Hotel, the southern headquarters for Huey Long. And Huey, when he was first sworn in as governor in 1928, he had only one speaker at his gubernatorial, and that was William Big Bill Thompson, who was the Capone-appointed mayor of Chicago. Now, Dandy Phil, I'll just tell you this last piece to give you an idea how deep this is. Dandy Phil Castell had two areas that he oversaw, New Orleans and Hot Springs, Arkansas. In Hot Springs, Arkansas, it was a mob mecca from the 30s. Al Capone maintained a 365-day-a-year suite in the Arlington Hotel because the mobsters would take a train out there to open up racing season. I've been there, and it became a mob mecca. And so am I suggesting that it's no accident that Bill Clinton is not from Little Rock, he's from Hot Springs? Yes, I'm suggesting that is no accident. So you find these people, you groom them at a young age, you nurture their careers. He became governor at the age of 32, having been a intern for Bill Fulbright. Bill Fulbright was, he held hearings on AIPAC in the early 1960s, trying to get the Israel lobby, trying to get them to register as foreign agents. By 1973, he's saying Israel controls the United States Senate. By 1974, he's out of there. If you're a smart young intern, meaning Bill Clinton from Arkansas, also a Rhodes Scholar, as was Bill Fulbright, that tells you really early on where your political bread is buttered. So when he went back to Arkansas, he knew who was going to fund and promote him and put him in office, and with him we got Bob Rubin and Madeleine Albright. And so is that how deep this is? Yes, that's how deep this is, and that's the next book in the series. It's about the criminalization of the U.S. president.
Well, and we can go on here to the profiling again. We've gone into it in depth here, looking at people's pensions for different activities, as well as, keeping a dossier of actual things they've already done, so that whenever pressure needs to be placed on these people to either sway in any direction, they don't even have to show what they've got. They can just point to a couple of the things they know about on top of that and say, play ball with us, and you'll continue to get a great paycheck. If you don't, not only will you be out of a job, but you'll probably be facing charges. So it becomes a no-brainer for a politician being held to that kind of extortion on top of the possibility of being enriched. Please don't tell on the fact that I had an underage boy in my house or so-and-so. Thank you very much for that $100,000 a month kickback I've been getting over here. So it works. They make sure they take care of their operatives who are important to them.
To keep in mind, for your listeners' perspective, is important. The most important aspect of this to understand is the use of assets.
Yep.
These are people who are not consciously operative in a crime, yet they are essential to the perpetration of a crime. And so the typical needs that you profile are the needs for influence, power, money, sex, drugs, alcohol, those types of things. You know within an acceptable range of probabilities that if you walked Monica Lewinsky in front of Bill Clinton, what his response was going to be. You know, this is not brain surgery we're doing here. This is not rocket science, you know. And so you put people in discrediting circumstances. The night that the Six-Day War breaks out in 1967, a former Irgun operative named Matilda Krim is in the White House servicing our commander-in-chief's sexual needs. And she's been, you know, he's got a long-time own-running affair, and she's the wife, 20 years the junior, of a fellow named Arthur Krim, who is in the leading fundraiser for the Democratic Party. She's formerly, in 1948, she's an Irgun operative. She's married to an Irgun terrorist. So So you fast forward 19 years, and you got her in the bed with the commander-in-chief the night that the war breaks out in Israel. That's how premeditated this is. That's how orchestrated. That's how you target people well before you put them in circumstances where they, you get them, you put people like a commander-in-chief, a very important operative in any kind of a operation you're trying to run. You put them in circumstances where you know within an acceptable range of probabilities how they're going to respond in those circumstances. You know, imagine if they'd said, you've been sleeping with the top fundraiser of your party, and you're the head of the party, and oh, by the way, Arthur Krim is head of United Artists and a big fundraiser. He found what's called the President's Club during Kennedy, you know, $1,000 dinner for a meet and greet with the president. Lou Wasserman out of Cleveland became head of, president of Music Corporation of America, became Universal Studios, Decca Records and whatnot. He founded the Counterpart out in Los Angeles. So Wasserman is squiring LBJ when he's still a congressman. He's squiring LBJ and a guy named John Connolly, who ends up governor of Texas. He's squiring them up and down the west coast of California, bedding them down with the starlets during the Second World War. So you profile these people long enough ahead of time. You know what their needs are. You know what they're after, what fuels them, you know, what drives them. And you feed that need.
Well, we've got here. You go into detail on the building of Murder Inc. and the company and the way that, you know, this. It's kind of like. And when did they start working within structures within the CIA and FBI? Because what we have today is complicity in these organizations, not in every FBI employee, not in every CIA agent or asset, but in fact, certain positions within certain people within those organizations are predisposed to helping this gang. And it's becoming clearer to anybody who looks into this stuff that they're keeping their mouth shut. CIA knows exactly how 9/11 was done. So does the FBI.
Well, let me challenge you on that, because I think this is, again, the power of association. People think it's somebody in the CIA, and they immediately associate that with the institution itself. And the same thing has happened in the United States, because we are associated with what the Israelis are doing in the Middle East. It's the United States that's associated with it. But in truth, it's not the U.S. government. It's a government within our government.
That's right. That's right. That was my point.
it's a hugely key distinction. If indeed we're going to try and recover, you know, our government from this government inside our government. People need to understand this is not your government doing this. This is people who've made it appear that it's your government doing this. You know, there's sufficient control. And again, you can go on criminalstate.com and look at the introduction there, and you will see how this crowd focused their funds on campaign finance as a way to displace, you know, representation that was placed on state and on district with who could raise the most money for these candidates. And that's become, and John McCain was a key operative in that. He and a guy named Russ Feingold out of Wisconsin were the key operatives in getting that done. And again, all this only works if you can do it in plain sight. You cannot possibly do this. It operates just below the surface, so it looks as though you're seeing a certain reality, when in truth what you're seeing has got a subterranean, you know, agenda behind it that you cannot see.
Well, you know, here's the interesting thing, though, Jeff. People like Agent Rowley up in Wisconsin, who was reporting, these people taking flight lessons and didn't learn to fly and blah blah blah.
And in Minneapolis, yeah.
Minneapolis, and so my point is that there are good agents out there, people who are doing their, earning their salary and working hard. They must be getting disgruntled. They must be getting angry on their own right, because many of them are privy to the information being shared on in your book and on my website. And the fact is, there must be some real heated exchanges. You know, Ray McGovern, of course, has a group of his own fighting for the truth. And I remember 3 years ago when he and I were putting out that Israel was behind a lot of this stuff. We were talking about it. This guy, you know, he briefed presidents, this man. So, I mean, there's people within the CIA, or retirees even, that are aware of this stuff. I'm wondering if we're ever going to get traction within these organizations against the people doing this stuff from within.
Well, again, I think that's how the way to cure this is you begin to put the assets themselves in a position where they realize they have personal liabilities. If you can persuade enough Americans that the that a president or a secretary of state or someone actually is, you know, they're operating not on behalf of the, and consistent with their constitutional oath, they defend the United States from all enemies, both domestic and foreign, but in fact are operating on behalf of a foreign entity, then they've got genuine liabilities. I mean, we're talking about ongoing treason. And the founders of the country were very clear about this. They knew, I mean, if you can imagine, throttle back 230 years, and you're trying to distinguish a, you know, an American revolutionary from someone whose loyalties run to the crown, you know, that's an internal state of mind. How do you determine that?
That's right.
And so they actually put it in the, you know, in the Constitution itself. They defined treason in there because they said, you know, if you're giving aid and comfort to an enemy, or if you're adhering to an enemy. Now the challenge is people still think that Israel is an ally. Once they realize this is how warfare is waged, they'll realize who the enemy is. And then you've got assets that have been helping them in the Congress and the executive branch and the FBI and the CIA, people that are helping an enemy. Now, some of them, I think, are doing it legitimately. I think it's part of their job. Some of them have a bias in that direction. And this is the subtlety of this. You know, how do you distinguish the people who are consciously doing this from people who are just doing, oh, I'm just doing my job. I don't have enough proof to prove this out. That's why we're sticking very close to our knitting. We're showing people how this works, but where you've got honest agents and the FBI and CIA and federal law enforcement, they can look at this and say, oh my God, you know, I've somehow aided this myself, you know. How have I, and we can come back to Colleen Rowley. I think she's got enormous problems once this unrolls, because she had evidence in front of her that well before the evidence that she submitted to the FBI director, that had she engaged it consistent with her oath of office, she might well have prevented 9/11 rather than coming back and discrediting the FBI from the inside. And you notice that she was then positioned to run for the Congress and of course, lost. But I think you're going to find this rally is not going to have quite the glowy reputation.
Well, that's true. And, I mean, it's the same kind of stuff when they were stealing the election with Bev Harris and the rest, going for governor after. And, oh, yeah, I mean, this stuff, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, actually, when you take a look at who helps them and who doesn't. We're going to call this a show here because we've been going on for an hour and 10 minutes. We've finished 25 pages. I know this is a slow process, but you're going to be invited back. In the next week to continue on with this to get to page 50, I hope. I'd like to go through this because ultimately these files will be heard worldwide by tens of thousands. I'm hoping hundreds of thousands, Jeff. By the time we get this thing completely done, we should be circulated globally. I'm certain of it. And it is a labor here, but I don't begrudge it because I think it's so important for the listeners to really understand the MO behind all this nonsense, and we're going to continue to bring out names, dates, associations, economic benefits that went to them, how they built new businesses and new associations, how they turned fortunes of $1 million into billions, which is $1,000 million. It defies logic to think that somebody with $900,000 in 10 years could be a multi-billionaire without having to pull some shenanigans, and of course we'll get into financial crimes, we'll get into international financial crimes, and so forth. This book is so full, Jeff, of information that it's going to astonish people as we go through it. And I urge every listener out there to go to Jeff's website and order the book. The book is just a remarkable read. It's a remarkable book. It should be on your shelf. It should be shared among your friends. And what we need to do is make sure that that people who are opinion shapers get an opportunity to read this. And that's that was my hope by doing these broadcasts. Jeff, thank you so much for doing this new installment, please.
Good to be with you. Thanks so much.
Ladies and gentlemen, Jeff Gates, the book, of course, is Guilt by Association, How Deception and Self-Deceit Took America to War. We are going to be continuing this, the Gates Chronicles on the French Connection, to bring everybody up to speed on this information. But in the meantime, I urge you to get the book. Until the next time, take care of your families. And please, ladies and gentlemen, be well. Bye-bye now.